This is Jessica, and you're listening to the Asian Madness Podcast. Welcome back to the Asian Madness Podcast. Always happy to have you here and hope you're all staying safe, making good life choices, and of course, keeping yourselves hydrated. I used to hate drinking water, but it's really such a simple but vital element in our lives. Anyway, I'm no health expert and no one signed up to hear about my take on water, so let me just get on to today's case. I went through this phase of Googling all sorts of keywords to find cases I had never heard of, but with an Asian element. And of course, that gave me various results, as you would expect. I ended up with results such as Lauren Patterson, Noreen Jaslin, and today's case, to name a few. So where are we off to today? We're going to the city of classic old double-decker buses and telephone booths. A country with a rich backstory that perfectly blends old-world charm and modernity. Within the busy streets and famous landmarks of London, stories of several serial killers and their victims are hidden, but some are hidden better than others. If you've ever been to London, you very likely know that it is a very diverse and populated place. The crowds alone can get intimidating, and sometimes people go missing without ever being found. This would be the case for a young girl, Elizabeth Chow, who one day disappeared. No evidence, no witnesses, no leads. She just vanished. Was she a victim to someone familiar to her, or was she preyed upon because she was a convenient target? Either way, her story needs to be told. This case takes us to the charming borough of Ealing, London. It's better known for its tree-lined streets that create a gorgeous countryside atmosphere. It's the perfect escape from the city's hustle and crowds, but for some people, the silence of these streets can mean something a bit more sinister. Let's begin. Elizabeth Chow was born in November of 1979 to Vietnamese parents who were living in London at the time. Everybody who knew her said she had a very vibrant personality, but she was also responsible even at the young age of 15. She never had a rebellious phase, which not many of us can say, and she knew exactly what she wanted from life and pursued that every single day. Unfortunately, I was unable to dig up any additional information on her life and background, but from some of her family's accounts, I am sure that she was well-loved by those close to her. In either way, both she and her family did not deserve whatever it is that happened to them. Fast forward a bit in time, we arrive in the year 1999, just before the whole Y2K thing. At this time, 19-year-old Elizabeth was a student at Thames Valley University in Ealing, where she was studying law and business, or perhaps computer science, depending on the sources you read. Thames Valley University has now been renamed, though, after several mergers and acquisitions, and is now known as the University of West London. Unsurprisingly, Elizabeth was a dedicated and committed student, wanting to work hard so she could provide a good life for herself and make her parents proud. Sounds stereotypically Asian, but there's some truth in that. Being a good student didn't mean she was a bookworm, though, with no social life. She actually had a surprisingly thriving social life as well, meeting friends every now and then, and always making time for family as well. What I'm saying is, both Elizabeth and her parents worked for years to make Elizabeth who she was. A good daughter, a good friend, a good student, a good member of society. One with goals and a clear path to those goals. Sorry, I know all this sounds rather cliché, but it can be cliché and true at the same time. So many victims are so young, and as people like to say, have their whole lives ahead of them. Young people can be some of the most passionate ones out there, where they still have dreams of what they want to be when they grow up, or they're just enjoying the process of becoming who they are as a person. It can take years to build something or someone, but all of that can also be taken away in a matter of minutes or even seconds. So, what exactly happened to Elizabeth? Let's fast forward a little bit now to April 16, 1999. It was a regular Friday for 19-year-old Elizabeth. She did not have any classes to attend, but she had to stop by her university to submit an assignment. She had planned to return home soon after that, but her plan changed when she got to campus. After submitting the assignment, she decided to celebrate by getting a drink with a friend. And so they ended up going to the student union, basically a place that provides all kinds of services for the students, including skill development, support and guidance, a place to meet new people, work out, and, you know, grab drinks, coffee, or food. One drink turned into two, and then three, as it happens when you're having a good time. She spent the whole afternoon there with her friend, but because she was responsible enough not to stay out late at night, she was on her way back home by 5 p.m. And while she was on her way, she came across another friend at Ealing Broadway around 5:30 p.m. It was a chance encounter, so she continued on her way right after saying hi to that friend. At this point, she was not far from home. Normally, she would be home pretty soon after this point, but not on April 16. When her parents realized that she was out later than usual, they started worrying that something might have happened. Elizabeth was not the type to change plans last minute, to stay out late, and her parents always knew where she was going and for how long. So with that in mind, Elizabeth's parents called the police when it got late and they had not heard from their daughter. Does it sound like they're a little overprotective? Perhaps in some families, but we should definitely keep in mind that families function differently and your dynamic would not be the same as your neighbors or your friends. So the police were notified and they tried to gather information about her movements in the hours after she left the student union at 5 p.m. CCTV footage near Ealing Police Station placed her just meters away from her front door, after which she was nowhere to be found. In that short distance, something happened to Elizabeth, or someone had taken Elizabeth away. Surprisingly, there was not even a single piece of evidence that could be used to start the search for her. No witnesses, no cameras, no objects belonging to her scattered on the ground. Her image caught on CCTV at 5:30 p.m., wearing a dark purple jumper, jeans, and brown boots. That was the last time anybody saw her alive. At home, all her belongings were kept the same way as always. Nothing out of the ordinary was missing, which only meant that Elizabeth had every intention to return home that night. Her bank records showed no unusual transactions either. So given all that information, along with her reputation, it was unlikely she decided to run away from home. Police conducted routine search procedures, questioning the neighbors and interrogating anyone who would have a motive to kidnap or kill Elizabeth, which was basically nobody because everybody loved her, or at least held no ill will towards her. As a very regular 19-year-old, the idea that she could have some mortal enemy was unthinkable. So it was believed that if someone did something, it had to be someone she was not familiar with. The police also combed through the place where she was last seen and found no clues. It was like a ghost had abducted her. And whatever happened to her, there was no camera around to capture that moment. After months of investigation, there was still no evidence that could help identify what exactly happened to Elizabeth Chow on that day. And just like that, it quickly became a cold case, but not for very long. Fast forward a couple months later, in January of 2000, another young woman went missing under very similar circumstances. Lola Shinkoya, an American woman working in London, was 27 years old at the time and was employed at Entertainment UK. She was a hardworking young woman, and according to her friends, a devout Christian who always tried to do right by her family and community. And just like Elizabeth, Lola was returning home after her workday ended when something happened. Lola got home and realized that the only keys to the house were with her sister, so she decided to hop on a bus to Ealing and wait for her sister at the local Burger King. Lola generally had no reason to even go to Ealing because she didn't work or live there. This was a one-time visit, and unfortunately, one time was enough. Lola's sister never saw Lola that evening. She came straight home and realized Lola was not around. And like Elizabeth, Lola always informed her loved ones if she was planning to stay out late. So predictably, the police had to be involved, and they quickly saw the similarities in the case of the two women. Both had vanished from almost the same geographical location. They belonged to approximately the same age group, and both had no reason to be considered potential runaways. Even Lola's belongings were at home, untouched, and her bank account showed no unusual activities since she was last seen. So the police decided to reopen Elizabeth's case. They also had a possible suspect in mind, now that there were two victims. Once can be taken as a singular occurrence, but when a second one takes place under eerily similar circumstances, it becomes impossible to ignore the similarities. Like Elizabeth, no one was able to dig out any arch enemies of Lola's, so the whole personal attack thing was scratched. And seeing the similarities between the cases of both Lola and Elizabeth, the police shifted their focus from personal motives to serial killings. In an interview, Detective Inspector Alan Rice Smith said, quote, "Lola and Elizabeth have disappeared in very close proximity to each other. This is either a complete coincidence or they may have fallen victim to the same attacker or attackers. I believe that they've both been abducted and murdered, and I believe that the attacker must have used a vehicle, a car, or a van of some nature. They've either forcibly abducted the girls, possibly by using some concealed weapon, or that they've either duped the girls to go with them in some way by using some deception, or perhaps because they knew him." Unquote. They had already dismissed the possibility that someone in Elizabeth or Lola's life was responsible for the disappearance. They decided to look into the possibility that both of the girls became victims of a common serial killer. And their new suspect was a man named Andrei Konowski, also known as the Beast, or the Beast of Mława. Andrei was a Polish citizen born on March 29, 1956, in Warsaw, Poland. His father was a construction site worker, his mother a homemaker. The Konowski family ended up moving to Mława due to his father finding a new job. Overall, his family life seemed to be very normal and average in a good way. But despite his parents being seen as upstanding citizens and decent people, their son, Andrei, was a different story. The first incident happened when he was around age 17. Where he was accused of sexually assaulting a girl. Although this crime was serious enough to warrant a stricter sentence, the judge gave him a short sentence of 3 years because he believed that a young boy was unlikely to repeat such a serious offense, as in, he could be rehabilitated. And that would be the first mistake made by the Polish justice system with respect to Andrei's case. After serving his 3-year sentence, he found work as an ambulance driver in Warsaw, Poland. With an ambulance conveniently always at his disposal, this became the beginning of countless rape and assault cases involving women and young girls. He used the ambulance to get close to these victims without alarming them, pretending to ask for help, and then grabbing them when they were least expecting it. Who would suspect an ambulance driver, really? This went on for a long time till he was caught again in 1980. This time, he was sentenced to 15 years in prison for 25 counts of rape and robbery, but ended up getting paroled in 1991 because of quote-unquote good behavior. But if the authorities expected that he would maintain this good behavior outside the prison, well, they were in for a surprise. He was seen as a suspect shortly after his release for the disappearance of a 14-year-old girl, but there was never enough evidence to pin this on Konowski, so her case also went cold. Andrei did not stop there. He went on to sexually assault two more teenagers before he got arrested yet again in 1995. Three teenagers and their families had their whole world turned upside down. But how could they have known that this man was dangerous? Kanowski at this point received a nickname, the Beast, a nickname that defined his nature in a scarily accurate manner. This would be the third arrest, which meant that the Polish justice system would no longer be lenient with him. And he anticipated this, so he decided to play the cough cough, I'm sick card with the courts, which granted him temporary release to get treatment. While he was out for his so-called treatment, he managed to sell his property in Moawa, then used his money to change his identity and acquire a fake passport. His destination? London. He arrived in 1995 and lived his life as a free man rather recklessly. He continued to pursue his fucked up fantasies, just in a different city. The thing is, he was never caught for those crimes. He was eventually caught by immigration authorities in March of 2004 because he was an illegal immigrant. And it wasn't until they ran his DNA that things started to click regarding the disappearances. One policeman ran his prints and found a few disturbing matches. Multiple assault and rape cases in Ealing and the rest of England, including girls as young as 12 years old. Katarina Koneva was one of the little girls who was just busy being a young girl when she became an unfortunate victim of the Beast. She had come home one afternoon after school, and she usually had to be alone for a while before her parents got back from work. Kanowski was likely stalking out the area because he knew exactly when to break into the house. Katarina was alone when he entered and blocked the door with a chair. He then began assaulting her, and once he was done, he tied a telephone cord around her neck and strangled her until he was interrupted by the father coming home. The father, sensing something was very wrong, tried to break the door down. That's when Kanowski jumped out of a window and ran. Katarina's father tried to run after him, but Andre managed to hotwire a car and escape. By the time the father got into the house, though, Katarina was no longer alive. Given the way these cases were connected based on his DNA sample, the police expected Andre to come clean. After all, there was obvious evidence, right? But he did not confess. He said nothing. The police were convinced it was him, but the search still had to continue. During their search, the police found something frustrating. There was no physical evidence that could be used to tie Andre to the disappearances of Lola and Elizabeth. The police only had circumstantial evidence, Ealing being his area of operation, and both victims being young girls slash women, which was close to his victim type. Not long after, in 2009, Andre died in prison, which meant that the chances of getting a confession from him were now gone. Even if he was the culprit, the truth had died with him. Things would be different if new evidence or witnesses came forward to prove this beyond a reasonable doubt. Unfortunately, after a lot of efforts in the following years, there still hasn't been any concrete proof that Kanowski was the man behind the disappearance of Elizabeth Chow and Lola Shinkoya. But of course, this case does not end here. In late August of 2014, 5 years after Andre's death, another girl disappeared from the Ealing area under very similar circumstances. On the one hand, this could prove that Andre wasn't the one behind these disappearances, or at least, not the only one. But on the other hand, it meant the streets were once again unsafe. 14-year-old Alice Gross went missing while walking along the canal in West Ealing. After an intense search, her body was found in a pit dug into a riverbed. This time, DNA evidence was useful in identifying the suspect, Arnis Zalkons. Arnis had already served a 7-year sentence in Latvia for murdering his wife after she came out to him. When the police identified that he was connected to Alice's murder, they began the manhunt. Arnis was also found to have allegedly drugged and molested a teenager back in 2009, but the victim declined to press charges, so nothing ever came from that. Arnis's ex-girlfriend and mother to his two kids told the police that she believed he was innocent. Sure, he was seen on camera on the same path as Alice, but that didn't mean anything, right? Basically, he was a good man. He was later found dead, though, and it was presumed that he had killed himself. There was a major manhunt for him, and it would seem he was feeling desperate and hopeless. It's frustrating, isn't it? It feels like you find one suspect, and then they play hard to get and die on you. You find another one, and they have the audacity to die again. If you're going to go around killing and assaulting women and girls, at least be brave enough to face possible consequences. It just proves how cowardly these people are. But let's keep going. Some detectives thought that the kidnapper might have been Arnis all along, that he took Elizabeth and Lola, and now Alice too. But after some more digging, it became clear that Arnis had no way of operating during the time of Elizabeth and Lola's disappearance, because he was in prison in Latvia at the time. So, not the guy they were looking for. That, of course, ruled him out as a suspect in their ongoing case. Back to square one once again. It would take nothing less than a clear confession to move any of these cases forward. Shockingly, though, a confession was not too much to ask for. Though real or not, you decide. Let's turn the clock back a little bit and meet Levi Belfield, also known as Levi Rabets, a man born in 1968 in Isleworth, London. His parents, Jean and Joseph, had five children total. Levi and his two brothers and two sisters. When Levi was only 10 years old, he lost his father to leukemia, and he and his siblings were later brought up in public housing. Levi went on to father 11 children from five different women, with zero intention of sticking around for any of them, whether to father them, teach them good values, or, you know, pay for childcare. Some might say losing your father at such a young age could have affected him, and while that may be true, it is not an excuse to be a deadbeat. In fact, Levi only ever sought out trouble. It started in 1981 when he was arrested for burglary, when he was only 13. He was then arrested in 1990 for assaulting a police officer, and then again for driving offenses and more theft. By 2002, Levi had 9 convictions and had served up to just 1 year in prison. I have no explanation as to why his sentences have been so lenient, but maybe because he was just a kid when he committed many of his crimes. Sure, he was doing bad things here and there, but none of his acts were of a violent nature, except, I guess, assaulting a police officer. I think if we lived in a better and safer society, we would recognize a problem and have government-funded rehabilitation programs, therapy sessions, or something to help people get on track before they go fully astray. But we don't live in a perfect world, so on we go. Levi was not rehabilitated, so safe to say, he did not find the errors in his ways. Instead, Levi Belfield began lurking on familiar streets to prey on victims, blending into the surroundings he knew so well. Several of his former girlfriends explained his usual pattern. His initial charm would rapidly turn creepy and controlling. He would start out as sweet and charming, and later in the relationship, he became entitled, egotistical, and controlling. It's not at all uncommon, and not all of these people turn to violence. At the time, Belfield concealed his pursuits behind the facade of a wheel-clamping business in West Drayton. Detective Chief Inspector Colin Sutton described Belfield as someone who thought very highly of himself, which also meant Levi was not the type of guy to take no for an answer, especially from women. 18-year-old Kate Sheedy was a woman trying to get away from Levi's advances, but he was angered by her dismissive attitude, so he decided to run her over with his car. Although Kate sustained multiple injuries, she escaped with her life and was able to give a description of the vehicle and of the man who ran her over. Belfield's menacing presence extended to casual conversations with young girls at bus stops, and 22-year-old French student Emilie Delagrange was one of such victims. Captured on CCTV, possibly encountering Belfield in her final moments before her attack. And this was not even the start of the horrors that police uncovered about Levi. They arrested him in November of 2004 for the murder of Emily de LaGrange, and he was charged with 3 counts of rape and the assault of another woman in the area. He was then charged with the murder of 19-year-old Marcia McDonald, who was hit over the head in Hampton on February of 2003. She died after 2 days in the hospital. He was also charged for the attempted murder of Kate Sheedy and another woman named Irma Dragoshi. The more the police talked to Levi, the more he talked, which was nice, but also kind of a horrifying experience because this guy had so many secret crimes and probably makes people wonder, why is he the way he is? So he spilled, starting with a crime Levi had committed when he was only 12 years old. Prior to being arrested for theft at age 13, it turns out Levi had strangled and killed a schoolmate of his, 14-year-old Patsy Morris. Patsy had been strangled somewhere on the path between home and school, and it wasn't until 2008 that Levi confessed to the crime. He apparently shared this with a fellow inmate in prison and even told him that Patsy was his girlfriend. It's also worth noting that Levi was absent from school on the day Patsy was murdered. Adding to the nature of his character, Belfield's former lovers described his total disdain for blonde women, targeting them for attacks. Patsy, being blonde herself, might have been the beginning of this violent obsession. Once he got a taste of murder and control, he wanted more. Finally, after Elizabeth Chow had been missing for 24 years, in 2022, Levi Belfield confessed to her murder. The confession wasn't made public until 2023, and in May of 2023, Belfield admitted to his acts against Chow and even pinpointed the location of her body on a map. Now that they had Levi's confession and even the rough location of her body, the police finally had something to give to the Chow family. But Levi's confession did not make the police go look for a body. According to the detectives who interviewed Belfield, there were inconsistencies in his statements, which led them to conclude that he was in fact not the perpetrator of the Elizabeth Chow case. Elizabeth's family, obviously distressed by the incredibly slow progress of the investigation, accused the Metropolitan Police of neglecting Elizabeth's case due to racial biases. So, either the police misjudged Levi's tone and made a bad call, or Levi is a liar and wants to establish himself as an even more infamous and notorious serial killer by taking responsibility for a long-standing cold case in London. It's not unheard of where killers confess to crimes they did not commit. It's a strange concept, probably, to people like us, but if they're already going to prison for life, then why not lie and confuse people more? Clearly, these people do not have a conscience, so they do not care if this lie causes more harm. Levi Belfield was ultimately found guilty for the murder of Marcia McDonald and Emily de LaGrange, and also the attempted murder of Kate Sheedy. On February 26, 2008, Levi received a sentence of life imprisonment with a whole life order, which means that the inmate will never be up for parole consideration. Despite already receiving a life sentence without the possibility of parole, he had a second trial in May of 2011 for other abductions and murders, this time involving the kidnapping and death of a 13-year-old girl named Amanda Dowler. Her death, though, predates his prior charges, and although he denied his involvement, the jury still found him guilty. In 2016, he would finally admit to killing Amanda Dowler, but later he would recant his confession. Not sure if this man is confused or he's just playing the public. Although this episode was meant to focus on Elizabeth Chow, we ended up with more victims and too many killers. So what is going on with Elizabeth's case, since the police refused to go digging around the area Levi Belfield said he dumped her? Imagine living for more than 20 years and not knowing what happened to a loved one. Then suddenly a man, convicted of multiple murders and kidnappings, says, "Oh yeah, I killed her." Would you not want to see this through? Sure, he could be a liar, but there's no way you wouldn't want to find out. The police department has claimed that the area Belfield told them about was too vast to dig around, which the Chow family called BS on. Because of this refusal, the Chow family has stated that they, quote, have lost trust and confidence in the police because they are acting too slowly. They are being very vague. They have not done enough. They have enough to go to the site to try and verify whether Elizabeth is there or not, unquote. And I kind of do agree. I know it's not that simple. There's SOPs involved in any line of work. But I really am curious to know if there's any specific reason the police do not believe Belfield's confession. The Chow family themselves have also acknowledged the fact that Levi Belfield is a murderer and a liar, so he could have been lying. But it doesn't mean they don't want to verify. The police have continued to state that they will keep in touch with the Chow family, and they will be informed of all updates. But at this point, it seems that nothing is happening. They are yet to finalize the decision of whether Levi Belfield will be charged with the murder of Elizabeth or not. Either way, Belfield is serving time for the other woman he hurt, and he will hopefully never experience freedom ever again. So, there you have it. A case initially involving one young woman, which ended up opening multiple cans of worms, leading the police to various suspects, but still, we have no confirmed answer for Elizabeth. Do you think Levi Belfield is to be trusted? Or do you believe her murderer was actually Konowski, also known as the Beast? Or perhaps it was someone else entirely that has not yet been identified, someone who has dodged any suspicion? Both men definitely fit the bill to some extent, so without further information, it is really difficult to say. Let's not forget Elizabeth's case is not the only one out there that's considered unsolved. Lola Shenkoya, the other woman who vanished months after Elizabeth in the same vicinity, also remains unsolved. It's absolutely frustrating knowing that there are so many options, and yet, none of them are solid. I do hope that one day we will get an update on this case, as Elizabeth's family, along with many other families out there, deserve justice and to know the truth. Please always remember to be safe, and especially so as a woman. Not trying to trigger people's paranoia, but it's just a logical thing to do. Thank you for tuning in. Please take care, and till next time.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.